It's really good to be with you today, and I'm going to just talk to you a little bit about the evidence of the fossils and how does it work through. And I think you've already been aware, those of you who came this morning, of the importance of foundations, and to a certain extent, I mentioned that, of course, yesterday as well. PISA reminds us, doesn't it, that, you know, without those foundations, be right, you're going to have real problems. And I was saying this morning that creation of itself isn't a salvation issue, but nevertheless beware, because underneath that iceberg is the biggest part. And if you crash into an iceberg, particularly like the Titanic, where you hold below the waterline, that's it, that's curtains. And there are hidden dangers not immediately obvious. Mixing evolution, I said this morning, and Genesis may cause shipwreck. So I'm not here trying to tell you that you've got to immediately get this right before you become a Christian. I'm not saying that, right? Please note that. But I am saying, if you have become a Christian, you need to join the dots in your thinking. Where does the Bible start being the Word of God? And one of the things that really helped me as a young Christian was when somebody said to me, Andy, have you ever considered the fossils? And I hadn't really, and I hadn't considered, you know, just the basic idea of what had happened according to Genesis. To me, it was a little bit off the wall initially, because I hadn't just really given it much thought. But then I began to realize that the fossils actually was a real key to unlocking how to look at the science. And as you well know, that most people believe this idea, I was saying this morning, the religion that most people are believing, both in Europe and in the USA, that life began in the sea, and gradually, you know, the fossils, they will say, shows to you life beginning in the sea, and then you move to reptiles, and then you move to mammals, and then some of the reptiles became birds, and then, you know, the mammals then... or some of the reptiles began to crawl out of the sea and become mammals, like cows, and some of the mammals went back into the sea to become whales, because a whale isn't a reptile, it gives a birth to live young, and so it somehow loses, you know, all the things that you'd think of a four-legged mammal on land, and quite amazingly, some of them become fins, and all the rest of it. That is really what evolution is teaching. And they seriously do teach that the mammals had first of all come out of the ocean and then some of them went back into the ocean. And then eventually we come to man. That is seriously taught. And of course, that is what a lot of you are being taught in the schools today. Now, if you're a Christian... And I'm not assuming, by the way, that you all are Christians. I know full well that often in a group of young people like this, a good number of you won't yet be Christians. But some of you are. And I just want you to see that Al Mohler, who's president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in... it is Louisville, that's right. Of course it's Louisville, Kentucky. He said, we are not talking about arguments in one of... this is a foreword to somebody else's book, he wrote this, but he's written many, many books actually on this sort of theme. But he summarizes things well here. He said, we are not talking about arguments over the interpretation of a few verses or even chapters of the Bible. We are now dealing with the straightforward rejection, this is in the church, not only of the existence of Adam and Eve, but of both of Eden and the fall. Though shocking, this line of argument is not really new. The new development is the fact that growing numbers of evangelicals are apparently buying the argument. Make no mistake, a false start to the story produces a false grasp of the gospel. So if you're a Christian here tonight, then if you're not believing in a literal Adam and Eve, and then eventually, as I'm going to be saying, a literal flood, then you've got real problems in understanding how you approach this book. And eventually you're going to end up thinking, as you get a bit older and as you still sort of hear more and more about what you think might be fact in the secular institutions, and you come here and you think, well, you're now beginning to think that what really I've been taught was fable, and you're now beginning to think, well, maybe the most of it's fable, and really, did Moses really lead the children of Israel through a wall of water either side, I was saying this morning, coming out in the Exodus, and was there really a Lord Jesus Christ who not only died but rose again from the dead? Dead men don't rise. And before you know where you are, you're actually falling way away into the world and realizing that, okay, you know, the whole thing's fable. So you got here Al Mohler saying, we've got to teach clearly to Christians, he's saying, we've got to join the dots as to that the Bible is the authoritative word of God, even from the word go in Genesis. So the issue, of course, as we approach this matter is Genesis 1 to 11 reliable? Is man just a different sort of ape-like creature? And anyway, does it matter? I hope you've already seen that it does matter. So that's just a little brief summary as to why we're looking at this. Now, some of you aren't yet Christians. And even those of you who are Christians need to realize that the science strongly shows that Genesis is correct in the flood. We talked a little bit about design last night, if you came to that meeting. And I was thinking of particularly the design of the ear. But now I'm going to begin to be looking at the issue that creation later on is followed by the flood. And is the flood really, is there evidence of the flood? And I want to show you, yes, there is. And I want you to rethink with me about the fossils. Now, what I'm going to do is actually consider the evolutionary position and then come back to the creation position. Now, let me define my terms, because some of you may be tempted to think that evolution is where you get the real science, and creation, well, it's not real science. You just believe it by faith, don't you? I want to show you that actually the creation stroke flood position, so when I use the word creation, I'm actually now using it as an overall term for the belief that Genesis is true, created kinds followed by a worldwide flood, that actually it is sustainable and it really does fit the evidence. Evolution says that molecules became men. That's basically what it does say. It says that given long enough light and stir once in a while, that like every few million years, you know, a pea soup of chemicals stir well, eventually will become men. Yes, the molecules will come together, it's saying, and then eventually it will form planets and, stars initially, and then you get from the stars, you get planets, and then eventually when the planets cool down, there'll be a pea soup of chemicals in the oceans of our particular planet, which eventually, hey presto, formed all the necessary molecules for life, and life began in the ocean of the order of 15 billion years ago. Well, that sounds all very plausible, it would seem. But actually, it doesn't fit. The creation position says that there was created kinds, but no common descent. Now, that's what we are actually thinking as those who believe in creation. That idea of common descent is denied by the sorts of things that I was saying last night, which show that each creature was made with a different characteristics. I was talking about the ear last night, and reptiles have different ears to mammalian ears, mammals which have ears. Or else I could talk about the difference between birds and other creatures, which are supposedly where they came from, reptiles, according to evolution. But reptiles don't have wings, in case you hadn't realised. And reptiles don't have the information in their DNA for making wings. It's not just a matter of having any old appendages which they might operate as wings. You've also got to have the control systems to operate those wings. And these are the things which clearly show from design that each creature is different. Let's just think about the giraffe for a moment. The giraffe has a long neck. It has a very big heart in order to pump the blood right up the neck to the brain. Just think for a moment what happens when a giraffe begins to stoop, which it has to do to get its mouth all the way down from, what, 3 or 4 meters high, down to, or the 12 feet, or whatever you're going to say in this part of the world. We use feet as well, and in fact, I'm a foot person. I'm not really a meters person, but, you know, I have to sort of think in terms of poor Europeans, you know, who still have to catch up. But maybe they'll be Brexiting or Frexiting or Grexiting or whatever soon. But we'll see what happens. But the giraffe has to come down and it has to drink. Well, imagine all this blood being pumped by this massive heart. It's going to suddenly have a brain hemorrhage, if you're not careful, because the blood is still being pumped to the brain. And if you lower the head, you're going to have flooding the brain. So how does the giraffe cope with that? It has special muscles on its neck, which actually restrict the blood flow every time it stoops its head. And of course they have to release, because otherwise the poor giraffe would keel over and not have enough blood coming to its head. Those are special design features. But did you know that you find giraffes in the fossil record? And guess what? They look like giraffes. And I want you to see, now I'm going to use an argument, which it means that I'm going to give the impression, just please follow me on this, that just for a little while, I'm going to be as though I believed that the geological record was a record of slow development, right? I'm going to say, okay, let's supposing you're right, Mr. Evolutionist, or Miss Evolutionist, or Mrs. Evolutionist, okay? And I'm going to say, let's just supposing that you're right about the fossils being evidence for an evolutionary development. So I don't really believe this, right? But this is what I'm using. I'm deliberately going into their way of reasoning and saying, let's see whether it works. You with me? Huh? Right? Okay, you're nodding. Anybody else look as they're asleep back there? Okay, are you nodding or not? Right? Okay, you're with me. Right? Good. Right. Okay. Not sure whether you mutated in sort of communications of body language as well as all the words in English. So does that mean yes and this mean no? Right, okay, you're awake, good, right. Okay, this is Precambrian. You'll have to get used to some of these names because they're used by the evolutionists. And these names, by the way, a lot of them are to do with my part of the world. Devonian is a reference to Devon in the southwest part of England. But this is Silurian, which is referring to Poland, where a lot of rock in Silesia has characteristics, and they call it Silurian. Cambrian, though, is referring to Wales, which is the western part of my part of the world. And so that is Cambrian granites, basically. And Jurassic, well, you've heard of the Jural Mountains, possibly some of you, which is southern Europe. And this is an important area because it's in this type of rock that you tend to find lots of things like dinosaurs, and you also find them into the Cretaceous. Now, Cretaceous is huge layering. A lot of the land around here will be Cretaceous near the top, okay? It's full of sandstone, limestone, chalks, and great swathes of America are full of Cretaceous fairly near the top. And a lot of England is as well. And a lot of Europe, the northern part of Europe, France and Germany, is all Cretaceous rock. It's very, very large layer. The Tertiary is obviously near the top. A lot of that's wiped away in places, and then the Quaternary. Don't worry too much about the terms here. Now, this, of course, I don't accept. This is the dates. But just for a moment, just let's think as though they were true, right? And this is what the evolutionary story says. Life began in the sea, as I said. Then gradually we emerged into forming these reptiles, and some of them became birds, and the other reptiles became mammals, and then got all sorts of animals like this until eventually man comes onto the scene. That, you well know, is in your books at school. Now, the point I'm making is that, supposing that's true, here's your giraffe skull, and it's no different to a modern giraffe. So even on their own reckoning, just in that little time scale there, and it's not so little according to them, it's about 22 million years, according to them, giraffes have remained the same. So I'm using their own thinking and throwing it back at them, right? That's what I'm doing here. We could talk about the feather. I could do a whole talk about feathers. Perhaps when I go to the school tomorrow, I haven't quite decided. No, the school on Tuesday. I haven't quite decided what I'll do, but I'll probably do something to do with flight. And the feather is just remarkable. It has this wonderful hook and ridge system which holds adjacent barbs together. So the feather is a remarkable thing. And we can find feathers not only today, but you can find feathers in amber. And hey, this is amazing. Some of the feathers in amber show the same characteristics of crisscrossing of barbules in between the barbs, which is the way that adjacent barbs hang together. But this is supposedly 99 million years old. Well, this is having quite a major effect then on our thinking, because I've already just shown you one 99 million years old. This is Archaeopteryx, which, by the way, it shows every evidence that it's a bird. It's just a bird, which is we don't have today. It was a bird which probably flew just as well as any other birds, but it did have teeth in its jaw. We don't have birds with teeth today, but it just simply means that in the past there were some extinct birds now, which had teeth in their jaws. Well, so what? We just have to accept it. And some of them, the Archaeopteryx also had a bony tail. Most birds don't have bony tails today. But they certainly had fully developed feathers. This is amber, similar to the one I just showed you, which is hardened resin from trees. And there is a feather which doesn't look any different to a modern feather. So what's the lesson from this? Well, this is interesting, because it means that the feather... I haven't put the one... which is 100 million years old, which obviously lies about there. But basically, feathers haven't changed. There is no difference. So we're learning something, that feathers have remained the same for 100 million years. This is beginning to look a bit odd, is it not? Now we begin to look at other creatures like butterflies. Over here, you have a marvellous butterfly. By the way, it doesn't fly as big as yet another butterfly. In terms of distance, it doesn't fly quite as long as people. Let me start again. Monarch butterflies do fly a huge distance in their migratory patterns, but there is actually one in Europe which flies further. Sorry, guys. But it's called the Red Admiral, and it actually flies a greater distance than the monarch. But the monarch is marvellous, as we know, because it does fly from Mexico. Some of them come through this part of the world and cross the Gulf of Mexico, and they come up through about Alabama and Louisiana, up through Georgia, and eventually wind up somewhere in the Canadian North. And then the other branch goes up through California and also ends up in Washington State, somewhere up there in the liberal part of the USA. And, sorry, being a bit naughty here. But anyway, the bluer part. Okay, but anyway, these two monarchs, whether they're liberal voting or Republican or whatever they are, but anyway, they all start, you know, making this journey. By the way, they actually do it. I don't know how they do it. Nobody quite knows this, but some of them are migrating north, and they just simply carry on going, and then they die off, and then they basically, the whole population knows that it's got to keep on going, so the children stop going further north, and then they go, sometimes it's the grandchildren still going further north, and then the weather begins to turn, and they begin to start coming back again. And it takes generations before the final generation comes and doesn't have it in its genes to go immediately to change. It sort of goes into a sort of hibernation in this one valley in the middle of Mexico, which was found 20 or so years ago, or whenever it was. Anyway, the point I'm coming back to is the fossils. You know that a monarch butterfly or any butterfly, red mantle will be the same, when if you were to just touch the wings of a monarch or any butterfly, it's enough to destroy the wing. It's so delicate, beautiful to look at, and marvellous in the way they fly. That's another lecture. You'll have to ask me to do that another time. But the way butterflies fly is not random. You talk about a butterfly mind, but actually that's not a very good use of the word butterfly. Butterflies know exactly what they're doing, and they can fly in a particular pathway. They're not particularly fast, but they do it. They fly right across the Gulf of Mexico. Most of them make it. Some of them stop off at the oil rigs on the way. They've begun to find a few little ports of call, and then they carry on. They are marvellous flyers. The point is, if you touch them, you damage the wings. Look at this. This is a butterfly, which you can find. It used to be sitting, this particular fossil, this exact fossil, I took a picture of in Albany State Museum, upstate New York. And there it was sitting. As soon as you went into the reception hall, there it was. I thought, yeah, I know this. I knew of this fossil, and I took this picture of it. It's a wonderful example of a butterfly, well preserved. But guess what? It looks like a... Come on, what does it look like? Okay, so what's the big lesson we're getting from this? The main lesson is, guys, butterflies haven't changed much. They look the same. But there's another message coming out of this. Because if you're now thinking through what I was saying about the wings, they're so delicate that they would be destroyed if you touched them. So how did we get that? Tick, 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 tick. What's that telling you? It's telling you something else. While you're still thinking, you're a bit slow, you Georgian guys. We've got a few Yanks here, Mike, sort of liven you up a bit. Anybody here? I'm going to start a civil war there. But what's this saying? Yes, Rebecca, are you a Yank? Well, sort of. Okay. Why do you say that? Can you say that loud enough so they can hear over there?
If it's that well preserved and undamaged, it must have been buried in sediment very quickly.
Why is that the case?
Because if there was turbulence, it would have been torn out.
Ah, do you see the point? Do you agree? Do you agree? Don't know what your name is, but do you agree? Right? You're too busy looking at him. You're too busy looking at her. Come on, look at the screen. No messing about. Sorry, I've been very naughty. But I was young once. I was young once. So look, guys. even you are laughing. You remember your youth well, do you? Really well. Yes, good. Even Hank's smiling. There you go. Pastor Hank. But there you go. Look, sorry, I better get serious. But look, what this means is that these creatures, which are so delicate, must have been buried. Did you hear what Rebecca's saying? Fast. Now, that's an important point, because what we find is repeatedly there is examples of creatures being buried fast. Not everything am I going to be able to play. I'd love to play some of these things, but I can't. Look at this one. This is a fossil. It's going round of a dragonfly, which is not quite the same as this one, which is a damselfly. Okay, this is a damselfly, but there's a lot of similarities. Basically, a damselfly has the ability much more to hover than a dragonfly. Dragonflies tend to not hover. They can, but they're fatter bodies, and they tend to just catch insects on the wing, whereas damselflies actually tend to hover much more, and they're more delicate. But the wings here are well preserved, and the one that's coming round is not actually the original fossil. It would have cost, I should think, the original fossil would be worth about $10,000. It would be so valuable. But this, even though that's a reconstruction of it, whatever you call it, it's please look after it. Don't break it, because they're fairly valuable. And this Well, I'm going to start passing the fossils around, even though I'm not yet talking about fish, but I just want you to have a look at these so you've got something to look at in case you get bored. And so these are some... Did any of you have a shrimp recently at the restaurant? Well, there's one in the rocks. So you can see the point that I'm making here is that the fossils show that everything looks very similar to what we have today. But I'm not... There's more to this. You know, I'm well aware of what the evolutionists would say to what I'm saying at the moment. So you've got to think with me, because I'm also saying that these creatures show that they were buried extremely quickly. So damselflies, yes, appear to have remained the same, but there's yet another issue coming out here which is strongly suggestive that something happened extremely fast. This damselfly lost one of its wings, the one I've just been showing, so there's only three wings there. But clearly, the very fact that you've got a very good impression of the damselfly is indicative that this creature must have been buried quickly. What is more, won't you find a dead dragonfly today at the end of your Georgian summer? I'm sure you find lots of dragonflies anyway. But when you get towards the end of the summer and coming towards the fall, you actually begin to see, if you look carefully, you'll just see the odd carcass of a dragonfly. And when it's finished its life, it finishes it usually with its wings open, almost invariably. And what do you think happens to that dragonfly carcass? Sorry to be a bit crude, but what does happen? Yeah, it might may get eaten up by something, or else if something doesn't come to eat it up, what would happen? It may rot, but because it's so hot in the sun, what's more likely to happen? Sorry? It just fries and becomes hard, and as soon as something might touch it, like even a twig or a branch, it will just... Sorry? Well, not quite shrivel away, but I'm just getting the idea of a hard, crisp carcass, it will just, come on, tell me, disintegrate, you got it. If you've got something hitting it, like a bit of mud, you wouldn't get any impression at all, it would just disintegrate. So how are you going to get the impression of that damselfly or that dragonfly? The only way you're going to get it is, as Rebecca was saying, that you're going to get it by... Only you're going to get it by rapid burial, okay? Rapid burial is also being indicated here. Now I'm going to play you something. You got the microphone? I'll use mine. It's okay. I'll use this one. It's too going to take too long to do it. So if I use this speaker, then I'll... just put my microphone on it, and it should pick up. So let me just put this in, and we should manage this. So, helps to switch it on. I will. That's a good idea. So this is David Attenborough talking about dragonflies.
The river has also been the home of another kind of insect with an equally ancient ancestry, and it too is beginning to emerge from the water. Bigger and more ferocious than the mayfly larvae, it has been feeding on tadpoles and even small fish. But that phase of its life is over. Now each one has to haul itself out of the water and into the air. On the top of its thorax, it carries a bulging backpack. It hunches itself and its outer skin splits. A very different creature begins to appear. White threads are drawn out of its flanks. They're the linings of thin tubes that penetrate deep into its body, air tubes that will enable the insect to breathe now that it is out of water. inflating its body, forcing fluid into the bundle on its back. Its wings begin to unfurl. Minutes later, the wings open. They'll never close again. Next, the huge muscles within its thorax must be exercised to prepare them for action. And it's away. Dragonflies, like mayflies, belong to the most ancient group of insects that flew over the land. And here in the museum in Harvard, there are fossils of them that are 150 million years old.
Now listen to the next bit.
They're almost identical.
Did you hear what he
with
said?
Species that are still flying today. However, they're by no means the oldest. We know that there were other dragonflies even earlier, 225 million years ago, that were flying through the coal measure swamps. We don't have complete specimens of any of those, but there are some tantalizing and amazing fragments, and here's one. This marvellously preserved wing has very much the same pattern of veins supporting panels of membrane as living species. The thing that makes it different is its size. From base to tip, it measures 12 inches, 30 centimetres. Little imagination is needed to replace the membrane that must have been there. This insect must have had a wingspan as big as a seagull's.
Okay, so you get the point that here we have learned quite a few things, actually. By the way, though it's not my main point in this talk, metamorphosis, which is when a creature changes from one body plan, appears to die and go into a pea soup of chemicals and comes out with a different body plan. A butterfly is an example of that. But a dragonfly is yet another example of that. To answer the question, how on earth did these evolve, is an exceedingly difficult problem. Because evolutionists have to say that at one instant, even in their evolutionary timescale, a second body plan suddenly came into being. Which, by the way, it's the second body plan which lays the eggs for the first body plan to work. Do you see the problem? So you've got a real issue with metamorphosis. And by the way, a dragonfly starts, as was indicated, with a nymph in the water. And dragonflies never go into the water when they become adults. And yet the dragonfly lays the eggs for the first body plan, which is the nymph, which is a voracious eater underwater. So these are just amazing facts, but that's not my main point. The main point is that the dragonflies are recognisable as dragonflies in the rocks. Okay, you got it? So where's the evolution of these creatures? The answer is there is no evolution of them. They're always there as dragonflies, supposedly 24 million years old. The same is true for damselflies. I'm showing you this picture because I took this in Canada when I was near Lake Louise, not far from that in the Rockies, and I happened to take one with two damselflies, which had just, one of them had just come out of its nymph casing there. But anyway, the main point here is that dragonflies have remained the same, but the other issue is, of course, that they're so delicate that actually with that wonderful fossil that you saw that David Attenborough showed of a giant dragonfly, wouldn't it be great to have met one of those? Well, that really would have been quite something, but I'm afraid there was also giant spiders in that era as well and lots of giant creepy crawlies, but we won't go into that. Might put off some of the fairer sex. But, I'm being sexist, mustn't do that. But there we go. But... But let me just tell you one other thing, and then I'll need to move on, because time, you've got your Super Bowl coming in, and no, you don't want to. Anyway, we'll forget about that. Hopefully this will be so interesting you won't bother to go. But that the plants, right, also show evidence that they were actually buried quickly. How do you get this fossil impression of, number one, it looks like a modern fern, and I took this when I was going through an airport, I think it was Albany, and it was on display, had some lovely displays. Sometimes as I go through airports, people put these fossil displays. And so I snap, 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 you know, take the pictures, because some of them are very good. And this is a wonderful example of a fern fossil from Pennsylvanian shale, which is the later Carboniferous, so it's about 240 million years old, somewhere in that time. And this fossil fern looks identical to a modern one, but how are you going to get a fossil fern? Have you ever thought about that? Well, when you pick a plant from its roots, within a day or so, it's withered, right? So how are you going to get this impression? There's only one way, and that is that the impression is made while it's still fresh. And what's more, the only way to get that impression is by catastrophic burial. So these are really important issues which show that plants as well as animals were buried quickly in the worldwide flood. Now look, I love this one. Yes, it was. This is the Pennsylvanian shale. It's a little bit beyond that, actually. It's more like 300 million years old in their timescale. But I love this one. This is an octopus. Now, an octopus has only one bit of bone, and it's near its mouth, okay? All the rest is cartilage. And cartilage will just disintegrate in the ocean. It will just rot away, and it'll just basically the carcass just comes to bits. And yet you can see on this fossilized octopus all the arms. You can even see the suckers, and you can even see the ink in the ink sac. Some of these fossils they have found of octopuses or octopi or whatever we call them, you can actually take out even the ink, which is still in the ink sac, and use it. Something's here is telling me that this idea that they are millions of years old and that they were gradually fossilized is wrong. They haven't actually got it right at all. I've got another picture of a fossilized octopus, here's one, where it clearly shows every evidence of being buried fast. And the evidence is that these creatures are, of course, the same as today. Now look, I need to move on. So there won't be an ice cream break for this talk, but at least you'll get the main point of this first part, which is that there, I could go all the way down the fossil record, and case after case after case after case shows, number one, these creatures are the same as what we have today and recognisable as such. Number two, that they were buried fast, right? Well, I've got a book here, have you read it, which talks about rapid burial. Do you think it's relevant? Of course it's relevant. But now here comes the evolutionist rebuttal. Andy, you've cherry-picked the data. And by that, they will say, what about the extinct creatures we don't have today? So that's a valid question, isn't it? So we'll look at two of them. One of them is dinosaurs. And as you can see, we're not denying that dinosaurs clearly existed. There are wonderful cases. This is, I think, in Utah, but or it's nearby. I actually once made a... you'll never believe this. Talk about Brits abroad. But my wife and I were driving, as you do, you know, in the middle of Utah, with very little water, right? We thought, well, we'll go and find this dinosaur footprint, because we knew that there was a dinosaur footprint in Utah. I can't remember exactly where it was. But anyway, we thought we'd brave the Mormons and go into Utah. And so we actually had some great fellowship with some Christians, actually, in Utah. We'd stayed in a tiny little place. But anyway... anyway, we went on this trip, green as we were, we're driving whatever it was, and we were driving hundreds of miles, and I said, dear me, where is this place? And we were way out in the desert somewhere. And it was wonderful countryside, most unusual, looks like a moonscape out there. And, you know, and we then found it. Oh, yeah, we've got to go over this railroad. And we then drove about 10, 15 miles on a rough gravel road. And eventually came to a spot where, yeah, there it was. Wonderful dinosaur footprints in the middle of nowhere. I was like, well, yeah, this is interesting. And then, would you believe it, in the car park, somebody else rolled up, and it happened to be, as you do, you know, it was a Christian. And it was quite remarkable. Not only were they Christians, one of them was from the Institute of Creation Research. And he knew all about it. And he says, oh, yeah, would you like some water? I said, yeah, please. And he had so much water that he could actually pour some water into the dinosaur footprint so he could really see it properly. And it was wonderful. And I've recently been in Peru, well, not this last year, but a year or so ago. And some of you know David Chandler. Well, he was there with my friend Stephen Pete out in Arequipa. And we drove out of Arequipa and we could see a whole string of dinosaur footprints way out in the middle of nowhere again. So there's no doubt these creatures existed. So what are we going to say about both them, and we're also going to say about these little creatures, dinosaurs, trilobites. Now, of course, I've got a little bit of a problem here. I could bring along a trilobite fossil, courtesy of United Airlines. They just let me sort of put them in to the hold. I once tried to bring them through my carry-on luggage. I had a few problems. So they said that I got something radioactive and I held up all the security line because of that. And they searched me and all the rest of it. So I no longer put them in my hand luggage. But anyway, look, I've got a trilobite fossil, and I'll talk about that in a couple of minutes. So you take that trilobite. Ignore the dating on the back, but at least there's a trilobite, and we're going to say something about them. But what I can't do is bring along a dinosaur fossil. Number one, they're a bit big, particularly a T-Rex. And number two, you usually can only get a few bones for the sort of price that I'm prepared to pay. You're not going to get something which is the whole creature. But what we'll do is we'll just consider briefly these two creatures which have become extinct. But the question is, are they in the process of evolving? And what argument are we going to use? I cannot bring along a pet dinosaur and compare the modern dinosaur, because we don't have them anymore, by the way, with a dinosaur from the past. And I cannot say, look, there's no change. I cannot use that argument. I cannot even use it with trilobites, although some people have said that they have seen some interesting track marks on the bottom of the ocean. And it may just be a wonderful discovery coming up soon when somebody actually finds a trilobite, which they thought had, you know, been dead for, well, extinct for millions of years. But in fact, they might find some. Who knows? But at the moment, we'll regard them as extinct. Now, what's so special about trilobites? Well, they're actually amazing because of the eyes. The eyes are multi-lensed. Now, the ones that you've seen going round, don't know where they've got to, you might just be able to see in the dim light that we've got at the moment, because obviously we're trying to look at the screen, but you might just be able to see that there is a whole series of lenses. That's how a trilobite eye looks. And this is a very valuable one where you can actually see the trilobite eyes made of lots and lots of little lenses. But get this, the lenses are like the fly you swatted the other day, you know, multi-lensed, multi-compound eye. But instead of the lenses being made out of protein that you're able to squash just like that, you say good riddance, particularly in the summer when they're swatting them right there, left and centre, you can actually see that the eyes are made of mineral. That's amazing. So these eyes, instead of being made of protein, they're made of calcium carbonate. Now, I've got a lump of calcium carbonate here. I need something else, which is in here. Now, this calcium carbonate, which I've got in my hand here, is a natural calcium carbonate not the calcium carbonate that you actually find in the lenses of the trilobite. But what I want you to do is to just pass this round. I'm sorry, it's a little bit ancient, the bit of cardboard that I'm passing round. I'm going to go around the young people here, and hopefully it will get round to the slightly older young people on my right. If you put this lump of calcite, which is natural calcite, on there, you'll see that it produces a double image. So the question that I'm going to ask is, was calcite used in the lenses of trilobites busy producing that double image, which is what they're seeing as it passes around? That's what they're seeing. And the answer is no. Now, a little bit of technical stuff here. If you're a physicist, you'll understand this. If you're not doing physics, you may just struggle a little bit on this point. But trilobite eyes, when you look at them up close, there they are. They're little lenses, right? There's thousands of them. And some of them, it may be more like 500, but usually quite a lot of them, about 5,000 or that thereabouts. And each one of those lenses has a center line, okay? Now, this lump of calcite that I've just passing around, which is a naturally formed crystal, there is one particular axis, and I won't go into all the detail, such that if you look down that axis, and it's called the special axis, those two edges will come together again. It's what's the technical term for this type of material is birefringent. You'd heard of refraction, right? Last time you did the washing up for your mother, maybe you said, oh, no, put it in the dishwasher. But, you know, she said, I want you to actually do some real washing so you know what we used to have to do, right? So she put a pot of water in there and you really had to do it. Well, if you looked at the water, you'd see that the bottom appears to be higher. We call that refraction, okay? Same thing happens in a swimming pool. The bottom appears to be higher than it really is, okay? Because the light bends it, or rather the water bends the light at the interface. Well, it's the same thing with this, except that it's birefringent. One part of the light is bent one way, and because light comes in two planes, and that's the way Polaroid lenses work, right? Light has got two parts to it. One part's at right angles to the other. And the other plane is bent at a different angle, so we call it birefringent material. So the upshot of all this is that there is one axis and one line of sight where they will come together. And would you believe it, the centre line of each one of those lenses is lined up to exactly that axis, which means that trilobites were not going around cross-eyed trying to work out what they were looking at. It's as though a wonderful optician had carefully made sure that each of those lenses was lined up exactly down that axis. Well, you know who the optician is? It's God Almighty. And that's what the evidence shows, that these creatures were not busy evolving gradually from something else, because there's no precursors to trilobites. The evolutionist uses a technical term. Well, it sounds technical, but it's really an excuse for saying he hasn't a clue. And the term that he uses is the Cambrian explosion of life. Sounds wonderful, doesn't it? This is where life really began, 500 million years ago. Basically, he's saying, I haven't a clue where it came from. But this is the life, right? Now, trilobites are meant to be simple. Question. Were trilobites simple? The answer is no way. They were complicated creatures, at least in terms of their optics. And so these creatures show every evidence of being designed. They would have had special DNA coding in there. If we could ever get the genome of a trilobite, you would find that once you worked it all out, that the instructions in the DNA would be actually making sure that the calcium carbonate was somehow centered around the center line such that you wouldn't get these double images. There are other things I could say about trilobites, like they even had correction for color formation, which you naturally get when you get fat lenses. I'm not talking about fat people with lenses, but fat lenses on people. And if you have fat lenses on people, they tend to form double, you get colours on the side. They even had a correction for that. Now let's move on to dinosaurs. Now some of them, I'm sure, would have been as fearsome as Steven Spielberg said, you know, in his film. But, you know, others actually wouldn't necessarily be in as fearsome as that. But the question is, were dinosaurs evolving? I'm being showing you from the intricacy of the design of trilobites, not by trying to say that here's a modern one, here's one in the rocks, but just looking at the fossil itself, there's every indication that these trilobites were anything but evolving, and they weren't changing into something else. They always were trilobites. And basically, they were just a form of life which has become extinct. What about dinosaurs? What do we know about them? Well, I'm going to use a somewhat different argument with them, because often, but not always, sometimes you'll find single burial of dinosaurs, but often you'll find dinosaurs buried with other creatures, and that's the interesting point here. In one particular case in Spain, in Lohueco, 8,000 fossils were found all buried higgledy-piggledy together. Most of them were armor-clad plant-eating dinosaurs, but some of them were creatures like crocodiles. Where do crocodiles generally live? Crocodiles generally live where? In the water? Near the water, at least, don't they? They go in and out of the water. Just grab a human or two from the side of the water and then go back in again and gobble it up, right? Or maybe a few other things as well, like dogs and cats and anything else they can get their hands or their teeth onto. Big creatures. Don't go near alligators and crocodiles. So what on earth were plant-eating dinosaurs, which are land creatures, doing with loads and loads of, well, not loads in this case, but lots of crocodiles anyway? What were they doing? And why were turtles there, which we know we have today? We know one thing, that crocodiles are the same in the fossil record as they are today, right? And these creatures are buried in the same layers. Here's a nice big crocodile, which I will avoid and not particularly go close to. And here's some giant crocodiles, which are buried underneath Niger in the middle of the Sahara Desert, which, by the way, shows that in the past, the Sahara Desert was not the Sahara, and was actually a swamp of some kind full of these creatures. So we know that crocodiles are found in the fossil record, and guess what? They look like crocodiles. Okay, you got the point. So crocodiles have remained the same. They're not actually any different. But just a minute, the dinosaurs are buried in the same layers, and in some places, they're actually buried in exactly the same rock, like the place in Lohueco. So what's this really telling me? Actually, I put it back to the evolutionists. Are you trying to tell me that the dinosaurs buried in the actual same layers, that the crocodiles are busy staying the same, but the dinosaurs, and some people seriously teach this, were gradually changing into birds? You can see that I don't really think that is going to work. Everything is telling me that this isn't the case. Here's another example of a small dinosaur, Psittacosaurus, and a turtle buried together in late Jurassic rock in the Shanghai Ocean Aquarium. The turtle is exactly the same as today. So the Psittacosaurus, which is just a small little dinosaur, was actually almost certainly exactly the same in its day as all the other ones. I wasn't busy changing into something else. So I would like to suggest to you that what we've really got here is that some creatures died out and some creatures didn't. So now we need to actually examine carefully another issue. And this is where we need another ice cream break, but I'm not giving you one, because we're now going to go into dating. Not the sort of dating that you might be thinking of. I'm talking about rock dating, right? And dating of rocks, which age, we've got to try and work out how old they are. Are they as old as people make out? Now, this gets complicated and sometimes, you know, people get lost in the detail. Let's try and just keep it simple. If you're going to use something as a clock, I need to set it. The technical term is I need to calibrate it. So I need to actually know what the time is at the beginning. And then if I'm going to sort of look a bit later on, I need to say, you know, and I've got a process going on. I need to sort of say, well, how long has it been going, whatever the process is. And I'm looking at the clock. I say, oh, it's been going about half an hour. But that's because I had set it to begin with. I've got to set the stopwatch or whatever you're going to use as the analogy, or else set the sand clock. Now, when we actually come to radioactive dating, there are a few issues that we need to just bear in mind. And this little film will act as an ice cream break, so we'll use this in order for you just to relax from listening to my English accent, which you think is so different. So here we go. We're going to listen to this. We're going to listen to 5 minutes on radioactive dating.
Nearly every textbook in Science magazine teaches that the Earth is billions of years old, and the primary dating method used for determining this is what is called radioisotope dating, or radiometric dating. Now, this is a reliable method for measuring absolute ages of rocks and the age of the Earth, right? Huh. First off, many scientists now regard the age of the Earth to be between 4.55 and 4.6 billion years old. Okay, so if this method is reliable and accurate, why the 50 million year discrepancy? That seems like a lot. But let's get into some details here and see what's going on. Keep in mind, there's all kinds of scientific jargon on this topic, and so we'll just present a very straightforward, simplified version of the process. Radiometric dating is the process of estimating the ages of rocks based on the decay of radioactive elements in them. Basically, there are certain kinds of atoms in nature that are unstable and spontaneously decay into other kinds of atoms. For instance, uranium will radioactively decay through a series of steps until it becomes the stable element called lead. The original element is called the parent element, and the end result is called the daughter element. Radioisotope dating is commonly used to date igneous rocks, rocks which formed when hot molten material cooled and solidified. The dating clock started when the rock cooled. During the molten state, it is assumed that the intense heat forced any gaseous daughter elements to escape. It is assumed that once the rock cooled, no more atoms escaped, and any daughter element now found in the rock is a result of radioactive decay since that rock formed. The decay rate is measured in terms of half-life, that is, the length of time it takes half of the remaining atoms of a radioactive parent element to decay. Now, of course, that can be measured in a laboratory, and it is assumed that since we know the decay rate, we can calculate backwards and come up with the age of the rock. But is that all there is to it? Here's where it gets tricky. It's true we can measure a decay rate using observational science, but there's another kind of science that is required to accurately calculate dates for rocks, and that is what we call historical science. Historical science deals with the things in the past, and therefore it cannot be repeated and tested. Dating methods require both types of science, because in order to get accurate rock dates, one would have to accurately know both the decay rate and the initial conditions of the rock sample, right? Since radioisotope dating uses both types of science, we can't directly measure the ages of rocks. There are assumptions involved. For instance, how do we know what the initial conditions were in the rock sample? How do we know the amounts of parent or daughter elements now in that sample haven't been altered by other processes in the past? How does someone know the decay rate has remained constant since the rock formed? The answer is, they don't. Let's simplify here and talk about a typical hourglass. Let's say you walk into a room and you see an hourglass with sand at the top and sand at the bottom, and some sand sprinkling from the top chamber to the bottom. Well, observational science would allow us to see and measure the sand, and then calculate how long the hourglass has been running, right? We could make our sand measurements and then calculate when the hourglass was turned over, right? Well, those calculations could be wrong, because we may have failed to consider some major assumptions, like, was there any sand at the bottom when the hourglass was turned over? Has any sand been added or taken out of the hourglass? Has the sand always been falling at a constant rate? Since we did not observe the initial conditions when the hourglass started, and we haven't been watching the sand all the time since then, we must make assumptions. All three of those assumptions can affect our time calculations. Now, of course, there's more to understanding all of this, but enough said.
So I hope you understood that. I'll be testing you afterwards with a little diagram and everything, you know, and all exam papers to be given to Johnny. But you get the basic point here, that radiometric dating assumptions involve a number of issues. You don't know what was going on at the beginning. You don't know whether something was added or removed in the beginning, not only on the top but the bottom as well. And you don't know that the rate of decay was the same. So there's some major issues. And when you look at some of the interesting examples that I'm now going to show you, like this ammonite, and I'm going to give you an example of an ammonite. Please don't drop this. This is an ammonite. This has got the positive and the negative, and it comes from Whitby, where Captain Cook came from, who was the best captain in the English Navy at the time, and he visited these parts, but he also went down to Australia and laid claim to that, and sadly ended up in what you pinched from us, Hawaii, which we owned at the time, and the natives killed him. But so Captain Cook came from Whitby, and that's where that ammonite came from. We got lots of them in England, but this is an ammonite from California. But this ammonite was found by a person who's a pastor, actually, up in Northern California near San Francisco. No, a bit up from there, Redding, as it says. And he actually found a lump of wood round it, which had fossilized. Now, the lump of wood can be carbon dated, and it comes out to be thousands of years. I'll come to carbon-14 very shortly, but I've got a few more things to say. But the ammonite comes from Cretaceous rock, which all the evolutionists would say is 120 million years old. But it's obvious that the two things were buried together. So which one's right? And you don't know. What it really is showing is that there is something really awry with radioactive dating. So what I'm now going to show you is really very interesting, because you know that dinosaurs have been found in Hell Creek in Montana. Dinosaur bones, there's a lot of dinosaur bones found up there in the mountains. And it's a lovely area, by the way, and in the winter it looks utterly majestic, and in the summer as well. It's really high up there in Montana. And Hell Creek Formation is really quite a well-known formation for finding fossils. Well, Mary Schweitzer, when she was up at Montana State University, found some bones, and she decided, of dinosaurs, and she decided to break one open and was amazed to find inside soft tissue, which you could have put into a microwave and had a T-Rex steak. Well, just a minute, there's something going on here, is there not? Because how can you have the marrow of a bone which was fossilized on the outside, but inside it's soft tissue? Still spongy. As I say, you could have sort of, not that you'd really want to eat it, but a dog might want to. And you could even see the blood vessels in the meat. This is strongly saying that this ain't 65 million years old. And I'm told that some of the fossils that they found in Hell Creek Formation in Montana, that when you go in there, you can smell as though it's rotting stuff. Very interesting. It's not the only place I've heard that you get smells associated with what's buried there. But there's something else here. You remember I said carbon-14? Well, just a minute. Some people have decided, on my side of this division between how to understand the science, between the secularists who say, oh, this is 65 million years old, and others who are on my side saying, no, no, they're not. I've got a book here, they say, which talks about burial of lots of creatures. And, of course, they're thinking that these fossils are not old. They're not as old as millions of years. And what they've done is they've considered carbon dating. Now, if ever you get into a discussion on radioactive dating, I'll come back to this slide, but you need to remember that carbon decays to nitrogen exceedingly quickly compared with potassium going to argon, rubidium going to strontium, and uranium going to lead that we just heard on the earlier little film, okay? And carbon-14 decays to nitrogen such that half the original amount has gone, the half-life. You understood that bit, did you, from the film? Or were you going to sleep then? Were you busy looking at each other, right? Okay, but the carbon-14 decays to nitrogen, right, in 5,000, half of it will decay, in 5,700 years. Now, that is quick, because if you're now going, that reduces to half. Now bear with me on this. If you now go another 5,700 years, a half of a half is? One quarter. A half of a quarter, if you go to three half lives, is an eighth, and so on and so on. You do it 10 times, it's 1 over 2 raised to the power 10. So you divide it by half 10 times, which for any computer scientist, 2 to the 10th is? That's right, 1K, right? Roughly 1,000, 1,024, he's right. Okay? So 10 half-lives is 57,000 years, so you've reduced it to 1,000. Let's really make sure and go to 20 half-lives, which means that you divide it by 2 20 times, not just 10, right, 2 to the 10th. Now you're going to divide what you've got over, after 10 half-lives, which was 1 over 1,000. You're now going to divide that by another 10, over 10 half-lives, so you're going to now go divide by 1,000 again. So 1,000 times 1,000 is 1,000,000. That's right. You should get your calculator out if you want to check that out. But, you know, but you've got 1,000,000th, right? So that is roughly 110,000 years, a little bit more, 114. Okay, so look, what this is saying, and get this, and please try and understand this point, is that if you find any carbon-14 whatsoever in the rock, it must be less, even though this is way beyond the biblical time scale, it's much less than what we're talking about in terms of millions of years. It cannot be more than 114 or 110,000 years. Now get this. Case after case after case is found of whether it be dinosaur bones, whether it be coal with carbon-14 in it, whether it be fossilized wood, case after case after case is found of significant amounts of carbon-14. What's that telling you? These bones, this matter of coal and carbon fossilized wood, none of it is really millions of years old. So that basically means that the whole caboodle of radioactive dating is wrong. The secularists have made massive assumptions, and they're all saying, well, we don't quite know, but we're not going to go public on that. And really, that's what's going on. I'm not saying they're all up to conspiracy, because a lot of people just haven't really thought properly. But there are some big guys who really do know that there is a real weakness in their reasoning. And they're not prepared to let on that there is a massive problem in what they're saying. So friends, what this is really saying is that you might say, well, how does that come to biblical timescales? That's not a big problem, actually. Because the amount of carbon-14 in the atmosphere is affected by the amount of cosmic radiation getting through into the upper atmosphere, bouncing off neutrons and causing them to collide with nitrogen, which then is made radioactive carbon-14. So this is the reverse process, if you like. This is how to make carbon-14. Now, it's known that the amount of cosmic radiation reaching the Earth is actually quite significantly affected by the amount of water in the atmosphere. Well, I've got a book here, did I tell you, which talks about a lot of water. Do you think that might just have had an effect? We don't know all the details here, but it's very likely that before the flood, there was less cosmic radiation getting through. So there's less amount of carbon-14 in the CO2 that creatures were starting with, which means that your initial assumption wouldn't be right of saying that the carbon-14 pool is the same in the past as it is today. It was probably a lot less, which means that your 30,000 years, like I had earlier, talking about these dinosaur bones, I didn't actually highlight it for you, but you'll notice that on some of these figures, looking at dinosaur bones, they got figures like 25,000 years, 30,000 years. Well, that just collapses down to biblical timescales. Wow. Do you see where this is going? I can't go back and prove everything to you, but everything is indicating that there is a very good, robust, coherent case that the fossils are primarily from the flood. So what happened to the dinosaurs? How come that they became extinct? Well, they went onto the ark and they came off the ark. But they came off the ark into a very different environment. You say you're not really saying that there was dinosaurs on the ark. I actually had a pastor known here, but I won't say who it was, who actually said to me, or one of his flocks said to me, I can't believe there was dinosaurs on the ark. But there were, friends. And that's where this is going. Because every creature which was land and air-breathing went onto an ark. Now, probably his vision of the ark was this. And that's the problem. You need to tear... Oh, sorry, I'll go around being vandalistic. But, you know, metaphorically, maybe just sort of park it to one side. But don't use these books which have the wrong ark in. Okay? Just forget it. They're causing trouble to the children. And that wouldn't have lasted 5 minutes. Maybe 5 seconds would be the limit for that arc. We call it the bathtub arc. Get it out of your mind, having just highlighted it. The bottom arc is the right one. So you see, if you get the wrong arc, you get it wrong with the dinosaurs. They won't squeeze in, will they? And of course it's fiction. And people laugh at us because they have the wrong idea of the arc. But if you have the right arc, which was approximately of the order of 450 feet, maybe a bit larger. The one that they're building at, or have built now, near Cincinnati at the Answers in Genesis facility. They've taken a longer cubit, so it's come out to be more like 500 feet. But it doesn't really matter. The obvious scale is huge, right? You could get almost two Boeing 747s end-to-end on this. God bless you, Mike, if you've got to go. Lovely to have met you and to talk to you. Maybe see you again by God's grace. Okay, I know you've got to go to the Super Bowl. Well, we'll let you go. God bless you, Mike. Lovely to see you. So the dinosaurs are shown to scale here. And of course, no, I wouldn't be so foolish as to put them on the top. You'd probably put them on the bottom, okay? So, and we know dinosaur eggs have been found, so you could have actually started them with young ones, right? He didn't take a full 80-foot long dinosaur T-Rex onto the ark. He could take a small young one, maybe just under a year old. And so then the ark... Then the dinosaurs would come off the ark as the ark rested on the mountains of Ararat, wherever that was, we don't quite know. And then they came out into a new environment. Sorry about the cartoon, but it makes the point. Dinosaurs saw a very different environment. This is why there is an interesting point that across Europe, and indeed some of the American Indians in their petroglyphs, record seeing these creatures. If you go to the, if you go to Utah again, and if you go to Kachina Bridge in Natural Bridges National Park, and if you go down to Kachina Bridge, you will find that there is no sign telling you, because the rangers don't believe that they can understand what they're seeing properly, so they won't see it in terms of a creation stroke flood position. There's Kachina Bridge. This is where we went, Juliet and I, many years ago. And we went through that bridge. We then looked the other side of that bridge. And there, as you're looking back, on the right, you can see a dinosaur petroglyph. Okay, it's not absolutely clear. I will admit that. But it is there when you look closely. You can probably just begin to see it here. This is the long tail. This is the 4 feet, and this is the long neck, okay? I'm deliberately upping the contrast so you can see it there, okay? That is a dinosaur petroglyph. It looks distinctly like an Apatosaurus. Well, if you're not convinced by that, other people in Europe were clearly seeing them. When you actually come to Carlisle Cathedral, which is not a very big cathedral, but buried in the middle of the nave, in the central aisle, is a bishop. I don't know much about this bishop, except that he died, you know, somewhere in the region of 1500. And round his grave are all sorts of brass carvings, including this creature with a long tail, four big feet, and a great big long neck, which comes back, and the head looks distinctly like a dinosaur. And if you're not convinced by that, we know that there were other examples. If you go to Cambodia, there is a temple called Angkor Wat, and there is what looks distinctly like a stegosaurus in the animals carved on that temple of the order of about 1,000 years ago. So that means that people were probably seeing these creatures and that they died out in different conditions after the flood. Not enough food for them to eat because they'd be mainly feeding on plants, but they would attack men, and that's why we get legends of St. George fighting a dragon. That's why we get legends across Sweden of Beowulf fighting a dragon. There's quite a lot of legends in Europe of people fighting these large creatures. Okay, they've probably been dressed up a bit, and people drawing rather fancy diagrams, like the Welsh flag has also got a dragon on it. Where did all this come from? Probably from a real encounter with these creatures, which may have got a little bit amplified as people told the story over and over again. But I would suggest to you that there is truth in these. Not only that, the Bible refers to a large creature called Behemoth in the Authorized version of the Bible. I don't know what your version says. You might have a different wording in the margin of your Bible. But it actually describes this creature as having a tail like a cedar tree. Now, some people put hippopotamus in the margin, or at the notes at the bottom, or else they put elephant. Have you recently looked at the tail of a hippopotamus? The tail of an elephant. I mean, that might be an interesting variety, but I've never seen them like that. So I would suggest to you that Job chapter 40 is actually describing Job. Have you seen Behemoth, which I made with you, it says. Dinosaurs were made, not millions of years ago, but made in the creation week. Do you see that we've got a coherent view of dinosaurs? But they died in the flood. Some of them went onto the ark, then they came off the ark afterwards. So friends, I'm going to leave you now with this little film, which I want you to watch. It's an important film, because it makes a very important point. It suggests to you what may have happened with the flood. We don't know fully all the details, but most of the geology community in the sorts of people that I mix with, creation stroke flood scientists, they take the view that the Earth's crust was split open at the time of the flood, okay? That water came up from the deep. And by the way, there was no England there, you'll be pleased to know. There was no British Empire. There was no Europe. Ah, but there was no United States either, right? In fact, you talk about the Great Split in 1776, but shall I tell you, there was another split. The land was all joined together. And that America and South America fitted round Europe, which is, you know, you're trying to... we won't go into it, all the politics, but you know, we're still connected, and we talk about this special relationship. Well, actually, we were right next to each other in the past, but it wasn't over millions of years that the tectonic activity took. We accept continental drift, but I'm going to suggest to you that the continental drift took place very, very fast at the time of the flood. Now, we can't prove that, but I think this particular view, I think, fits very well. So let's just have a look at this. See whether this will work. So we've enjoyed it today, but there's a serious message in this. Lads, lasses, listen. The rocks speak of judgment. And I'm going to ask you, are you ready for the other judgment that's coming? You are facing huge changes in our society today. The message that you are hearing from Pastor Hank, Pastor Johnny and others here, and the elders and the deacons, you're just, you know, just don't assume that they'll always be there. The world is becoming a darker place. And the Bible says it's going to become very dark before Christ comes again. Don't play with these truths. If you've understood the Bible, you need to respond. Because the judgment is coming. Not by water, but by fire. This is 2 Peter 3, if you read it. What was the safe place then? It was obviously in the ark. If you weren't in the ark, basically you were lost. But you could be saved. And there was ample room in that ark. People have done calculations that probably there was about 55,000 creatures on that ark, the average size of a sheep, and it would have roughly filled half the volume of the ark. There's no problem getting all the animals on. That's another talk which I won't do now. The safe place was in the ark. What's the safe place today? The cross. Let me ask you very seriously, have you come to the cross? I don't mean literally taking a cross around your neck. I don't mean literally going to a crucifix as the Catholics would teach. You know, we're not talking about that sort of idolatry, which what that is. I'm talking about actually coming, metaphorically in a picture, coming to Christ and saying, Lord, I've heard this truth. I know it's true. And I'm going to submit myself to the Lord Jesus Christ. You can't escape it, guys. You can't escape it. Stop playing. Ladies, be serious. This is the gospel. And the reason why the fossils are there is that you might see that God in the past has judged the world. All these fossils speak of judgment. 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 And God has said, I'll never do that water judgment again. But he is going to judge the world by fire. So I ask you seriously the question, on which side of the cross are you? There was one thief who was saved, and the other thief was lost. One thief called on the Lord, the other thief didn't, as far as we know. It's never recorded that he did. One thief was immediately into the presence when he died of Christ, his Saviour. The other thief was held in the waiting place, which still exists, for all those who will eventually be turned, I hate this, but it actually says it in Revelation, into the lake of fire, which is even worse than the physical fire which is going to engulf this world. Because that lake of fire, the fire never goes out. Are you serious with Christ? Some of you are Christians and you're not yet serious in actually, how can I put it, embracing the gospel. It's one thing to say, yeah, I believe it, you know, the Lord saved me and I know it happened. But so that you know for deep down you're not really following the Lord. Let me test you out if you're a Christian here. When did you last read this book? Did you read it this morning? Did you pray this morning? When did you last go to a Bible study? When did you last pray with someone else? I make the practice of reading my Bible through in a year. I found it an enormous blessing. I became a Christian of the order of 48 years ago. I started doing this about 40 years ago, thereabouts, maybe a bit longer. But it means, look, please don't think it's any credit to me, because you can read the Bible and still not get it right. But you can do the count. Obviously, I've read it over 40 times. Now, that's been a great blessing, because at least I know where things are in the scriptures. Right? I know roughly where what's going on and who comes where. And look, become familiar. What I'm saying is, if you're a Christian, embrace the gospel. The Lord is waiting for some of you to be serious with him. I'm going to go further. Some of you need to consider doing missionary work. Some of you are in the prime of life, and God is calling you to get into missions. To say, I'm not going to necessarily go for a secular job, which I'm offered. It's not wrong to go for that. Because some of you may be called to go into university like I did, and you know, do your best at the university, and then the Lord uses you in your capacity in secular science or whatever to then go out and reach the many who still are struggling with the issue of evolution. But that's not everybody's call. Some of you are being called to do direct missionary work in a Muslim country. That's pretty hard work. My son's doing it in Indonesia. Are you being serious with Christ? That's what I'm asking you. You need to get serious. You need to begin talking with Johnny here, Pastor Hank, and some of the deacons who are really serious, godly men here, who are leading this work, and say, I believe the Lord is calling me. Start talking to them, praying. If you're not a Christian, I've got one or two booklets here. And don't come up immediately, because I don't want to embarrass you. But if you want to, just while we're milling around with whatever we're having, I don't know, some T-Rex steak or whatever it is we're having. But, you know, we're having some food and some drinks. But just come up to me quietly and say, Andy, I'm not yet a Christian, but I'd like to know more about how to become a Christian. I know that this is right, but I'm not yet closed with Christ. Now, God is the one who does the business of saving. I'm just a mouthpiece. Pastor Hank is just a mouthpiece. Pastor Johnny and the deacons here, mouthpieces. We're all trying to say, go to him. Come to Christ. I can't force that. I can't make you a Christian. No, we're not walking the aisle or doing anything like that, friends. I'm just simply inviting you to simply say in your mind, this is serious. I need to come to the Lord Jesus Christ. The Lord is calling you, right? He's calling you and saying, Mary, come to me. Peter, come to me. John, come to me. He did that to me 48 years ago. I was at a crossroads, literally standing at a crossroads. I went there the other year. I was a bit disappointed they hadn't put a plaque there. But I tell you what happened. My friend, who was leading the youth work in the Episcopalian church that I was in, but he was a good man. He really loved the young people. He said, Andy, are you a Christian? I said, I hope I am, or words like that. He realized I wasn't. He said, Andy, you need to admit you've done wrong. Andy, you need to believe that Jesus died for you. Andy, you need to commit your life to Christ. A, B, C. As simple as that. And suddenly it was like the scales fell from my eyes. Whoosh! I grasped it. Being a Christian is not a set of rules. It's not a sentimental assent. It's not signing a card. It's nothing like that. Being a Christian is simply submitting to Christ. Not at a distance, but personally. And saying to Christ, he is my saviour. And that night, I went to my room and I just committed my life to Christ. And I prayed something like this, Lord, I admit I'm a sinner. I believe that Jesus Christ, the Son of God, died on the cross in my place. And C, I'm committing my life to you. Here's the keys. I'm handing it over. I went to bed. And the next morning, you know what I felt like? You know what it is to have a bath? Sometimes you have a bath, proper bath, not just a shower, a proper bath, right? And I felt like having a bath on the inside. Whoosh, I felt clean. I'd never felt clean before. Not really. Smutty would be a summary of my life before. Smutty. You can think, what you know, you can unpack that in your own mind. I wanted to pray. I wanted to read my Bible. I wanted to be with other Christians. It went up and down, and I backslid at times, and we all do. We all make mistakes, and big mistakes sometimes. But the Lord was very gracious to me. And 2 years' time, it will be my jubilee. Wow. I'm telling everybody, it'll be my jubilee in 2 years' time. 50 years a Christian, and I don't regret it, friends. At the age of 16, coming 17, I became a believer. And I'm so grateful that the Lord called me. Now, have you understood the truth? I basically had only understood the truth then. And I ran. Said, this is it. I knew it. Have you understood the truth and you've not yet run? You're still lingering with the pig's will. To use the analogy of Luke and the prodigal son. Come away from the pig's well. Do you know, in that story, it's the father who runs when he sees the prodigal. The prodigal began to go home, and the father saw him in the distance, and he literally ran to meet him. What a story that is! I tell you, our Saviour, our Heavenly Father, so loving is he, that he runs to meet us as soon as we begin to turn. So do you think that you're too bad to be forgiven? Forget it. Nobody's been as bad as I was, really, inside. And the Apostle Paul, who was one of the most brilliant of men, he said he was the chief of sinners. Right? You can come. Come today. May God richly bless you and turn you to himself. I appeal to you. I appeal to you. Don't go to bed tonight without having really sorted it out between you and God. I'm not asking you to put your hand up. I would never do such a thing. But in your heart and mind, will you say yes to that in your heart, to what I've just said? Don't go to bed tonight without having really sorted it out between you and God. I'll leave that with you. May God richly bless you.